From TexasObserver.org, you're listening to Observer Radio. I'm your host, Jonathan McNamara. This is a half-hour radio news show in which we ask the Texas Observer staff to take a break from writing and say things to you on the radio instead. Later in this episode, we'll be joined by Bill Minutoglio to talk about his new book, Dallas 1963. But first things first, we've got news to discuss. Joining me in the studio is Observer editor Dave Mann, who was not at last night's happy hour, making the whole thing a little less happy. Welcome, Dave.
It's good to be here.
Also joining us is Observer staff writer Patrick Michaels, who enjoys soda, so deal with it. Welcome, Patrick.
Thanks. Thanks for having me. I'm all caffeinated and ready to go.
Good. I'm glad to hear that. Well, for a few weeks now, we've been covering the fate of HB2, also known as the anti-abortion bill. Dave, I understand you have an update for us.
Yeah, so the Supreme Court finally came back with a ruling, and it wasn't good news for the abortion rights side. Excellent news for the anti-abortion side. The upshot here is basically that Texas's anti-abortion law will remain in effect, the key provision being that abortion doctors have to have admitting privileges at a hospital within 30 miles, and this has proved to be a big problem for abortion facilities all across the state. We've seen about a dozen or so abortion clinics close or stop offering abortion services. And you've now got whole areas of the state where abortions are not available and women have to go hundreds of miles.
And we should mention not just for abortions, but related services.
Well, mostly for abortion services, yeah. I mean, there are clinics that can still offer family planning services and all these kind of range of women's health services, although those have been cut as well.
Right.
We've seen some of those clinics close too. But this has mostly been just affecting abortion doctors and women looking for abortions. Now, what had happened was that the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals in New Orleans had, you know, put in this emergency order that allowed this law to take immediate effect, and that's why the abortion clinics started closing. That was on Halloween. And so then Planned Parenthood and other abortion rights groups appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court. And the ruling came back was, we're not going to overturn the Fifth Circuit's ruling. And so the law stays in effect. But this is not the end of the saga. Basically, the Fifth Circuit is going to hear oral arguments in January and then make a ruling. You can probably guess that that's not going to be a good one for abortion rights advocates. And then everybody kind of assumes this is going to end up with the Supreme Court. And it's kind of up in the air how the Supreme Court will rule. I mean, they kind of came down on the state of Texas's side this time, but there's clear indications that that wasn't a ruling necessarily on whether the Texas law is constitutional. When it goes to the Supreme Court, it's not clear how they're going to rule right now.
So this was just about, you know, did they meet the burden of arguing that this injunction was going to be damaging to have it in right now?
Yeah, it's a really high legal bar. And I'm going to preface this by saying I'm not a lawyer, but
this is not legal advice for anyone listening.
Yeah. But apparently the threshold was, well, you have to show that the Fifth Circuit made, you know, a substantial mistake, a substantial error in judgment in granting this emergency order. And, you know, five justices ruled that, you know, that they didn't meet that standard. They didn't meet that very high bar. But there wasn't any comment on whether the Texas law itself was constitutional. And it was noticed by a lot of people that both Anthony Kennedy and John Roberts did not sign the majority opinion. So it was a 5-4 decision. They voted with the majority, but they did not kind of weigh in. So that would seem to indicate maybe their opinions on this are up in the air. And, of course, there were four justices that were against it. So
there was even a, if I'm remembering this correctly, a concurring opinion from Scalia and Thomas that was even more extreme, than the main opinion. So it kind of sets out this sort of spectrum of places where you can imagine the justices might fall.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to do kind of a simple reading, I think it's 3-4 to the Texas law, 4 against, and 2 kind of up in the air. Although the caveats are that in the majority opinion, Antonin Scalia wrote it, and even he said, you know, people have differing opinions about whether this is constitutional or not, and we're not going to decide that here. And even in their dissent, the four liberal justices said, we're not arguing that the law is constitutional or unconstitutional. We admit that that's a very difficult question. All we're saying is that the emergency order wasn't warranted. So the upshot of this is the law is going to be in effect for a long time because, you know, it's going to take a long time for this to get to the Supreme Court. And when it does get to the Supreme Court, you know, who knows what the outcome of that is going to be for all the marbles, pretty much.
And at that point, these clinics in Texas that have closed already will have stayed closed for a long time. It'll be much harder for them to open, even if
months
the ruling goes their way.
Yeah, exactly. So even if the ruling goes their way, it's not clear that they'll ever open again. So the damage may already have been done. As cheery as that is.
Sunshine and butterflies.
Well, from there we go to a type of story we don't normally tell, which is about how the State Board of Education is a little bit less interesting.
This is, it's maybe less thrilling and goofy than,
I found it quite thrilling before.
It was. Well, it's notorious as sort of the place where, you hear the wacky theories about evolution being nuts and global warming skeptics get a great big stage and sort of, the fight over religion creeping into public schools, has just traditionally been played out, for 50 years in the State Board of Education. So now this week they're poised. We're recording this on Thursday, and Friday morning they're going to take the vote on approving new science textbooks for Texas. And it looks like they're going to not insert any new language that's meant to sort of, dampen the enthusiasm for evolution.
Wait, what?
So textbooks, there's language that some folks had wanted to insert in these textbooks that would basically suggest that evolution is questionable, dubious. There are reasons why maybe we shouldn't trust it so much.
That's just like your opinion, man.
It is like their opinion, man, and it's going to stay their opinion and not in the textbooks. Probably because the State Board of Education won't let that language into the books.
What's this world coming to?
Right. I mean, where else do we look for our wacky education news? And the answer is probably going to be in local school boards. Basically, because of new laws in the last few years, local school boards have a lot more power over approving curriculum and which books, not the curriculum, but which books the districts get to use. So a lot of the groups that have been traditionally fighting at the State Board of Education for this stuff are now turning to local school districts instead. And one of those is in Longview, where just earlier this week, there was a school board meeting where a number of speakers got up and complained about C-Scope, which is the embattled curriculum program that's supposedly un-American and all about how the Boston Tea Party was run by a bunch of terrorists and global warming is great and, Agenda 21 and, UN conspiracies. And
this is paving the way for the UN takeover of Texas.
Exactly. Right? And so the UN clearly is interested in what happens in Longview. In the public schools.
Rightly so.
And some parents got up and raised their concerns about that. Not coincidentally, I would posit, David Dewhurst had just visited a few days earlier and was campaigning against C-Scope as part of his bid to remain lieutenant governor of the state. So it's interesting in the lieutenant governor's race that Dewhurst has sort of found what he thinks is a wedge for himself to get back in the Tea Party's good graces or get in their good graces for maybe the first time. Over education, because his rival, maybe his main rival, Dan Patrick, is seen in a lot of ways to have dropped the ball on C-Scope. He came out really strong early on against C-Scope and proclaimed that it was dead and it was over with. And it turned out that wasn't really the case, that it's actually still in schools under a different name. And he looks to a lot of these activists like he goofed on that, and Dewhurst is trying to kind of beat him up over it. But I think the response from the Tea Party folks to Dewhurst's presence is pretty fun because, of course, he's still lieutenant governor because he's not in the U.S. Senate because Ted Cruz beat him in this race on the strength of the Tea Party support he got. So there are a lot of folks in the Tea Party in Texas now who see Dewhurst as sort of this, seeking redemption through them and a reminder of how much power they have because they got the other guy elected here and now Dewhurst is courting their support too.
He's like a captured man, basically.
Yeah, he's got no choice but to eat it up and just go with it.
So Dan Patrick made, a big deal over kind of a phony controversy that it was never really a big problem to begin with, and then
depending on who you ask.
Or who you ask, yeah. I mean, yeah. Or maybe it was
Depends how much you love freedom.
Right. Exactly. So then they fixed it, but then they didn't really quite fix it. And now Dewhurst is attacking Patrick for not quite fixing the phony controversy that he never really got involved with in the first place.
Exactly. It looked like Dan Patrick was showboating. He's up on Fox News talking about, you know, how terrible and un-American this was, and how he killed it, basically. Kind of, and the optics were that he took credit for killing it. And then when it sort of, you know, came back again, Patrick became pretty unpopular among the folks who were trying to get rid of it. And Dewhurst sees this as an opening for himself.
To kill the zombie Seascope.
Yeah, once and for all. He won't rest because he doesn't sleep.
Zombie Seascope is trademarked, by the way.
That's true.
Well, guys, thanks for sharing that zombie story. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Observer Radio, a half-hour news show by the folks at the Texas Observer. Joining us now is Saul Elbine, who wrote a piece for the Observer's November issue called Skeptics Gone Wild, Navigating America's Conspiracy Theory Culture. And one of the interesting things about this story is that it sort of helps you develop a philosophy about conspiracy theories. I quite like, I know that the other members of the staff like it too, which is, well, it might as well be.
Yeah, so I'll just cut to the punchline of the entire piece so that if you're going to read it after
skip
you
listen to the good
this,
parts.
It will be
ruined
for you. And that's the piece ends with this anecdote from when I was about 22. I was sitting at a table at Spider House Coffee with this dude named Jeremiah, who was talking about the lizard people conspiracy theory, which is that all events on Earth are controlled by this powerful elite who is secretly lizards, or Sumerian gods, Sumerian god lizards from the planet Nibiru.
I saw that episode of Doctor Who.
It's everywhere. They surprisingly, the lizard people let this be published.
Right.
Really the surprising thing. So I said, he was saying something about the Queen of England needing being a lizard person. And I said, Jeremiah, for real? And he said, well, I'm not saying they are lizard people. I'm saying they might as well be lizard people. And I thought that was great. I thought that was just like a great sort of evocation of the, this was, I think, before the 1% and the 99%, but it's just such a great send-up of that idea. Like, I'm not saying that they are carnivorous aliens from another planet. I'm saying they might as well be.
They're so remote from you know, the daily experience that you or I have that, why not?
Yeah, I think in a world, I think too much ink gets spilled and too much gets talked about whether conspiracy theories are true, and not the sort of anthropologically observable fact that people believe in them. So, you know, I think the question of whether the Bush administration caused 9/11 is less interesting than why a quarter of the population believes they did. You know, like in a country where a quarter of the population believes that something like that could have been carried out by the government, that seems like it is a mirror that reflects other things as well.
Right. So it's not the reality necessarily. It's more the perception.
Yeah. It's like sort of how anthropologists will study, you know, Greek culture by looking at Greek myth. Nobody's like, well, did Zeus really turn himself into a swan to have sex with women? Like, that's not even really the important question. It's, you know, what is the function of that story?
Well, you mentioned a few conspiracy theories in this piece and also a few people who sort of peddle conspiracy theories. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. So I listed a number of conspiracy theories which were later proven to be facts. I'm just going to rattle off a few of them. There was the Gulf of Tonkin, in which the Johnson administration lied about a North Vietnamese attack to pull us into the Vietnam War. There was the 1968 October surprise, in which Nixon tried to sabotage the peace talks in Vietnam to get himself reelected. There was a later one with Reagan, where he did the same thing let me make sure I say this right. He allegedly made a deal with the Iranian students and the Iranian student revolution so that they wouldn't release the hostages to get to make Carter look bad. So there's all of these sorts of things which are later verified. And then there's things like the idea that the Oklahoma tornadoes from last year were caused by federal weather weapons. And that one comes courtesy of course, if you are into this sort of thing, Alex Jones, who is one of our neighbors here in Austin.
Right.
And who is, I would say, almost, at least in his persona, I don't know what the man is like personally, is like a religious conspiracy believer. Everything could be conspiracy. He takes the might as well be philosophy to its absolute logical extreme. And in doing so, he sort of highlights this distinction between conspiracy as, you know, a sort of a legal or scientific idea in which you can say, you know, anything, any crime that was caused by a bunch of people conspiring is a conspiracy. Any theory about that is conspiracy theory. And then there's also this other idea that a conspiracy theory just means anything that is not acceptable to talk about. It's crazy talk. So Jones does both. Jones does all conspiracy without distinguishing between any of them. So there will be federal weather weapons, and then there will be something like the NDAA, which allows the Obama administration passed, which would allow it to arrest anybody and indefinitely detain anybody found to be giving support to Al-Qaeda or the Taliban. So these two things will be treated equally by someone like Jones.
Well, and you've got this great bit in your piece about how, you know, you talk to someone who kind of theorizes that maybe Alex Jones was a government plant to put out these ridiculous conspiracy theories alongside, you know, the actual conspiracies, just to kind of
draw attention.
Yeah, to make everything look equally ridiculous. So there's actually this conspiracy theory built up around Alex Jones himself, right?
Now, interesting thing about that guy, he also had booby-trapped our backyard in case the G-men came over the fence. I would always find these like strategically broken glasses around the fence line.
So, I mean, how deep does this rabbit hole go?
Well, infinitely deep, I guess. I mean, there's, you know, I think what it comes down to is everything in the world, I mean, in the modern world anyway, is we all live in this sort of framework of other people's opinions and things that other people have told us. So, like, I don't know how my computer works. I don't really know how my car works. I don't really know where my food comes from. I don't know where any of this comes from. I'm holding a phone right now, which is put together by processes I don't understand. And at this very fundamental level, we really are, you know, in this world, which might as well be magic, frankly, for all that we really understand it, and we structure it based on what other people have told us. And the problem is, once you stop trusting what other people have told you, there's really no way for the rabbit hole to have a bottom. And this is sort of what happens with Jones. I mean, I think, not to pick on him particularly, but if you really don't trust what the people on top are telling you, then there's no reason to trust, you know, anything they're telling you.
And of course, another conspiracy theory you mentioned in your piece is the Kennedy assassination.
Yes, I do.
Timely enough.
Very timely, considering that actually we're recording on the 21st. Tomorrow is the anniversary.
Well, one thing Saul, one of the things I was interested in your thoughts on is you know, what you read into the fact that so many people, even today, believe that there was some kind of conspiracy built up around Kennedy's assassination.
Well, I think it's a complicated phenomenon, right? I mean, we're talking about 62% of the country believes that. We're talking about, God, over 150 million people. I mean, how could we even begin to speculate about, you know, the motives of all of those people? But I was talking earlier about these statistics of conspiracy believers as being like a reflection or a mirror, and the question of what they might be a reflection of. And I think in the case of Kennedy, one of the things that that's a reflection of is that the government just refused to acknowledge that how weird everything that happened with Kennedy was. They sort of brushed it under the rug. And then over the next 5 decades, there was just incident after incident of you know, either very suspicious behavior or proven high crimes in sort of the highest levels of American society. And again, like, none of these things were ever dealt with in any organized way. It was
Can you give us a specific example?
Blip, and it was another blip, and they are all these sort of aberrations, but there were so many of them.
Right.
And I think it's some reflection of that. I mean, I don't think there's any reason to believe anything that they say.
Yeah, I mean, it clearly traces to that time period where there's this huge drop in trust of government, you know, starting with the Kennedy assassination and then, like, Pentagon Papers and why we got into Vietnam and the Vietnam War itself, and then Watergate and up through Iran-Contra and all these kind of continuing scandals where people find out whether the government's actually lied to you.
Right, Dave. And when you say it like that, there's this, you know, you suddenly hear a narrative. You hear, oh my God, like, those things are all, like, you know, a couple of years apart. But we don't discuss it like that, really. I mean, when I was taking, you know, government in America, we didn't talk about high crimes. You know, we would talk about, oh my God, Watergate was this thing that happened. Oh my God, Iran-Contra was also this thing that happened.
Right.
And usually when there are articles about this, they'll just sort of mention those. It's like they'll toss them off, like, oh, this happened. Oh yeah, that happened. Well, those things were huge deals. And there were, like, you know, two of them per presidential term in every term for the last, you know, 50 years.
And now we have Obamacare. The biggest conspiracy of all.
Yeah, from our president, who is secretly from Kenya.
Maybe we're starved for conspiracies.
It's been a few years. We're overdue. Yeah.
I read that 60% of the Republican Party was polled as believing that Obama had lied on his birth certificate.
He was filling out his birth certificate.
I mean, that's hard. It was hard to do. He can't even hold a pen.
His birth certificate was fictitious.
Well, I guess we'll just have to pass that story around. We'll have to think about it out loud. We'll have to get drunk and discuss it.
That'll be next week.
Yeah.
I'm going to run it by some lizard people.
Whoa. We're bringing them in?
Only off the record.
Okay, fair. Well, Saul, thank you so much for sharing your conspiracy theories.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it, even though you're all lizard people.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Observer Radio, a half-hour news show by the folks at the Texas Observer. And I have with me, joining us by phone, Bill Minutaglio, who's got a new book co-authored with Stephen L. Davis. The book is called Dallas 1963, and it focuses not specifically on the assassination of President Kennedy, but the atmosphere of Dallas at the time. Also joining us is Observer Managing Editor Brad Tyer. Welcome to the show, Brad.
Thanks. All right, well, jump right in. Bill, the book is Dallas 1963, and as you're aware, there's a flood of books on the Kennedy assassination out this season. This one's more about the place than the act. Can you tell us a little bit about what you discovered about the atmosphere in Dallas in 1963?
Sure. Thanks for asking. It's a good question. There are a gazillion books out there. Somebody told me there were 40,000 books written about Kennedy, which seems like a lot.
You read them all for your research, right?
Absolutely. I read them twice, in fact.
Wow. Okay.
but then again, I'm 300 years old, so I had a lot of time. But who wouldn't be biased in terms of describing their own work? But I think we tried to do something different in taking a look, not so much at the assassination or the conspiracy theories, or, quote, Kennedy's fulfilled or even unfulfilled legacy as a political figure.
Mm-hmm.
And as well, there's another subgenre, the kind of I was there memoir. I'm not besmirching any of those. They're all good genres. But what we decided to do was take a look at a place and really what we're calling now a personality that hadn't been written a whole lot about. And that would be the city of Dallas, as if you would personify it. So it was a figure kind of in the drama and the build-up, certainly to the assassination, and what we really did want to concentrate on was the build-up, the three mm-hmm. to 4 years prior to Kennedy coming there, and how, at the end of doing a little bit of research, a little bit of homework, we decided that there was no place on earth quite like Dallas at that point. It was the headquarters of the extremist right-wing resistance, to use a charged word, against Kennedy. It was just where the sort of the moral and spiritual attack against Kennedy was emanating from. It was where the millions of dollars that were being spent to undermine him and thwart his reelection were being funneled out of. It was where the politicians were coalescing, and even where the media in America was coalescing. It was an amazing convergence, and the irony, of course, it would sort of begin in Dallas, and then of course, Kennedy would perish in Dallas.
Well, and that gets into a question that I want to talk about I want you to talk about the connective tissue a little bit. You got ahead of me there a little bit. I was going to ask, was any place else like Dallas at this time? Yeah. And you just told me that no. What's the connective tissue, though, between that atmosphere in Dallas and the assassination? You get into this question, and I'm sure you've heard it. Do you blame Dallas for the assassination?
Yeah.
Talk about that a little bit, if you would.
Yeah, it's another great question. And it seems like the anomaly, really what I maintain and my co-author maintains in our book, Dallas 1963, that at that time period, the most extreme right-wing figures in America had kind of coalesced. It wasn't a conspiracy. They happened to be in Dallas. They were attracted to each other, like negative energy seems to attract other negative energy. They just pulled together there. You had the world's richest man, H.L. Hunt, spending millions to create extremist right-wing radio in America, or to perfect it, really, in Dallas and aim it directly at Kennedy. It was broadcast to 10 million listeners a day, something called Lifeline, the Lifeline program. You had Reverend W.A. Criswell, the most powerful Baptist preacher in America and the head of First Baptist Church in Dallas, assailing Kennedy as someone really practicing the dark art of Catholicism. He was very suspicious that Kennedy would undermine true Christianity. You had the publisher of the Dallas Morning News, Ted Dealey, who thought Kennedy was just simply anemic. He yelled at Kennedy to his face one day at the White House and said, "You're just like Caroline riding your tricycle. You're just like a little kid. You're going to get us annihilated mm-hmm. by the Russian bear." So, you know, you have these extremist figures on one end, and certainly on the right wing, but the anomaly, of course, you know, Brad, as you're mentioning and alluding to, is that it was a leftist and avowed Marxist, Lee Harvey Oswald, who assassinated, by most consensus estimates, is the one who assassinated Kennedy. So how does that figure? And I'm not a psychologist. I probably need one more than most. but I think that, you know, as I've read a lot about Oswald and then talked to a lot of historians and other folks, they've described him as a very malleable, impressionable figure who really wanted to leave a big footprint in history. He had defected as a Marine marksman to the Soviet Union, and he thought that was going to, the world would come to a halt. The people would make international headlines, and nothing really happened. He had done it really, some people say, as an act of self-aggrandizing, that he thought, he would just draw attention to this page of history that he would write. So my sense is when you create a hothouse environment such as existed in Dallas in the years prior to Kennedy coming there, this vitriol that was increasing day by day, and not just in words alone, there were other things going on. It was an angry city. The crosses were being burned on people's lawns. Swastikas were being put on the front windows of Neiman Marcus, the most famous store in Texas.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. King came to visit Dr. Martin Luther King in 1963 to Dallas in January, and a bomb threat was lodged against him. So there was this anger and this fear about socialism, Kennedy, integration, many things in the air. And here's Oswald, someone who is just deranged. He was a brutalizer. He brutalized his wife. He had tried to assassinate someone else prior to Kennedy. He tried to knock off a right-wing leader who happened to be headquartered in Dallas, somebody he considered really almost a fascist.
Right.
So he had a predisposition to violence, even to murder. And you put him in that environment, and I, again, I'm not a psychologist, but I think he was influenced by this climate of hysteria and fear and might have been, you know, motivated to do what he did because of it.
All right. This climate of hysteria and fear does not seem terribly historically distant. you can recognize some parallels. I wonder if you... I don't know if you presented the book in Dallas yet, or what kind of response you've gotten there.
I love Dallas. I used to live there. I spent many years there. Some of my best friends in the world. Mm-hmm. I was worried that there was going to be a moat filled with alligators and maybe some razor wire. But you know what? I found quite the opposite. I found a lot of folks. I gave a chat at a bookstore up there just a few days ago. And it was a pretty packed audience by my standards. And, you know, you never know. Just look out over there, over the audience, and you wonder how people are going to receive a book that suggests that the city I was in, and that many of these folks had grown up in, might have been really, again, this epicenter of hate mm-hmm. toward Kennedy. And really what I found was that people were quite reasonable and said, you know what, we realized, I'm paraphrasing what they said, but most people said to me, what really happened in Dallas was that a handful of people who lived above the cloud line hijacked the microphone. The folks
right.
who had some money, who had access to the pulpit, and access to the media at a very high level had frankly coalesced and really created this incorrect image of Dallas as a city of hate.
Bill, we have run out of time on that note. Thanks for joining us and sharing a little bit about the book. It came out this month. It's called Dallas 1963.
And you guys are the best. So thanks for putting up with me and having me.
We've unfortunately reached the end of this episode, but before we go, I'd like to thank Rosie and the Ramblers for providing our music, and of course a big thanks to all of you out there for listening to us. Observer Radio is recorded at the lovely Co-op Radio Studios in Austin, Texas. Our sound engineer is Tracy Scholes. For more Texas news, visit us on the web at texasobserver.org or pick up the latest copy of the Texas Observer at a store near you. We'll talk at you again next time on Observer Radio.